It's almost impossible to ignore, isn't it, how deeply intertwined our lives have become with the digital realm.
Totally. Everything from banking to just talking to family, it's all online.
Yeah, and well, with that convenience comes the other side of the coin. These ever-growing, ever-smarter cyber threats.
Okay, let's unpack this because we've just had a look at the latest NZ Incident Response Bulletin, and it's shedding light on some really crucial shifts in this ongoing battle.
Exactly. For this deep dive, we've been sifting through that bulletin, and it offers a fascinating snapshot, the key cybersecurity and digital safety trends impacting New Zealand right now.
And for you, our listener, someone who wants to be in the know, but maybe without getting bogged down in all the technical weeds, this is for you. We're pulling out the essential insights, those aha moments that will give you a clear and actionable understanding of what really matters.
Yeah, we're going to cover quite a bit of grounds, looking at everything from new measures to protect your money in NZ banks, significant cybersecurity upgrades at the NZ Defense Ministry,
To concerns from business leaders about, well, the direction of our national digital strategy.
and we're looking internationally too.
We are. We'll touch on some pretty big things happening overseas, like large-scale banking password theft and attacks on pension funds over in Australia, the global fight against scammers, some GDPR actions.
Ah, GDPR fines and investigations.
Yes, against a UK law firm and looking into X, formerly Twitter. Also, issues with an AI chatbot in South Korea, record cybercrime losses in the US, and really important updates to the NIST Cybersecurity Incident Response Guidelines.
Okay, quite a list. So let's get started right here in New Zealand. Some news that, well, might offer a bit more peace of mind for bank customers.
What's really interesting here is this proactive step the New Zealand banking sector is taking, these new fraud protection measures. They're actually committing to reimburse customers who fall victim to scams.
Reimburse. How much?
Up to a pretty significant $500,000. It's set to kick in November 30, 2025. It does make you wonder, is this just about protecting consumers or are there maybe broader economic things pushing this?
$500,000 is, yeah, substantial. How are they planning to stop the scams happening in the first place, though? Are there new technologies involved?
Their strategy seems to involve a few key areas. They'll be using more advanced tech to sort of better spot suspicious transactions,
Okay.
which should let them freeze potentially dodgy accounts faster. They're also bringing in a confirmation of payee service.
Confirmation of pay.
Yeah, think of it like a digital double check, making sure the name on the account actually matches who you think you're paying.
Yeah, that sounds smart. That could tackle those scams where the account number looks right, but the name is totally different.
Precisely. And on top of that, banks will give warnings before you finalize a payment if it looks risky.
Retransaction warnings, okay.
And they're setting up 247 channels for reporting scams. So it's definitely a move towards helping customers act faster.
Now, that $500,000 reimbursement, is that like a guarantee every single time someone gets scammed?
Not quite. There are a couple of conditions. Firstly, the payout depends on the bank having actually done its part, implemented these new measures properly.
Right.
And secondly, the customer needs to have taken reasonable care. So, yeah, it's a significant safety net, but people still need to be careful online.
Right. Okay. So it's not a free pass to be careless, but it does sound like, well, a meaningful step towards better protection.
Yeah.
And it lines up with what's happening internationally.
It seems so. If you connect this to the bigger picture, it kind of suggests a growing understanding in the finance world that, look, they have a real responsibility to actively defend customers against these scams, which are just getting more sophisticated, more relentless.
Okay. Let's turn now to the NZ Defense Ministry. They're also making some pretty significant moves to bolster their cybersecurity.
Yes, they've put out a tender, basically looking for outside help to strengthen their cybersecurity infrastructure. The bulletin is quite blunt about it, actually. It says their current systems are becoming increasingly vulnerable to cyber attacks.
Increasingly vulnerable. That's quite an admission for defense.
It is. And that vulnerability in such a key national institution, it does raise questions about potential risks in the wider geopolitical context.
That's a pretty frank assessment, yeah.
Yeah.
What kind of money are we talking about here? Is there a big budget for this?
Looks like it. The ministry is planning to allocate a substantial sum, somewhere between $100 million and $300 million over the next 4 years. It's part of their bigger $12 billion defense capability plan.
Okay.
And the initial phase is focused on what they call the Cybersecurity and Support Capability Program.
And what kind of tech are they actually looking to buy?
Well, the tender mentions needing things like a threat intelligence platform.
Yeah.
Basically a system that gathers and analyzes info about potential cyber threats, helps you anticipate and hopefully prevent attacks, and also a planning system to improve how they coordinate their cyber defenses.
The bulletin also mentions something about the equipment's origin being important because of financial constraints.
Yeah, that's a really crucial point. Cost is always a factor, of course, but the ministry is also putting a strong emphasis on, well, trusting where the equipment comes from.
Right, supply chain security.
Exactly. And the security measures around installing it. Given how sensitive their work is, they have to be super cautious about, you know, potential backdoors or vulnerabilities hidden in the hardware or software.
Makes sense.
Their goal is to keep their cyber-connected capabilities resilient and, you know, maintain their status as a reliable partner.
Okay. Shifting focus now, let's look at the concerns coming from business leaders. It sounds like there's a bit of unease about the government's current digital strategy.
Yeah, this comes from the 2ANZ Digital Priorities 2025 report. They surveyed CIOs from major NZ organizations, and a key finding is this feeling of invisibility, they called it.
Invisibility.
Yeah, when it comes to government leadership on digital transformation, you have to wonder, what are the potential long-term consequences for New Zealand's progress if that feeling persists?
Invisibility is a pretty strong word. What's driving that feeling?
Well, despite some initial optimism after the change in government, a lot of business leaders feel that concrete policies and actions just haven't really shown up, especially in critical areas like AI governance and, significantly for our chat, cybersecurity. There's just a sense of disappointment, I think, that the early enthusiasm hasn't really translated into tangible support or a clear strategic direction from the top.
And how does cybersecurity specifically fit into those worries?
It's consistently ranked as a top priority for these business leaders. They're particularly worried about New Zealand's slide down the global rankings for cybersecurity and privacy protection. So the report basically calls for a cohesive national digital strategy, something with bipartisan support, you know, and proactive measures to actually tackle the changing tech landscape. The underlying fear seems to be that without strong government leadership and a clear roadmap, New Zealand risks getting left behind.
Right. It sounds like a call for a more unified, more decisive national approach.
Mm.
Okay. Now let's look across the Tasman. Australia's had some pretty alarming incidents recently.
Indeed. There was a recent investigation by a cybersecurity firm, Devolm, and it revealed a really significant problem. Over 31,000 sets of banking credentials.
41,000.
Yeah. Belonging to Australian customers of the big four banks. And they're being traded online by cybercriminals. It really highlights how vulnerable individuals still are, even when the banks themselves have strong systems.
Over 31,000, that's a staggering number. How were these details actually stolen? Was it the banks getting hacked?
No, and that's the crucial point. The main way seems to be through InfoStealer malware.
InfoStealer.
Yeah, it's malicious software that infects people's personal devices, mostly Windows computers. And its only job is to steal sensitive info, passwords, credit card details, stuff stored in your browser.
So just to be clear, this wasn't a direct attack on the bank's own security systems.
That's what the bulletin emphasizes, yeah. These breaches came from compromises on individual users' personal devices. The malware works quite stealthily, often goes undetected for ages while it just keeps sending stolen data back to the criminals.
Wow.
It really underscores that even top-notch bank security can be bypassed if your own device gets compromised.
That's incredibly unsettling, isn't it? It means even if your bank is Fort Knox, you, the individual user, are still a major weak link potentially.
Exactly. And what's particularly concerning is that experts warn this kind of malware can even get around multi-factor authentication.
How?
By stealing the authentication tokens themselves. The Australian Signals Directorate even calls it a silent heist.
Silent heist. That really drives home how important it is to keep our own devices secure, doesn't it? Making sure security software is up to date, being super careful about downloads, checking accounts.
Absolutely. It's a stark reminder. Cybersecurity in this digital age, it's a shared responsibility. It goes right down to each individual user.
Unfortunately, the Australian financial sector faced even more trouble recently. coordinated attacks targeting major pension funds.
Yes. Back in April 2025, several of Australia's biggest pension funds, Australian Super, RT Rest Super, Insignia Financial, yeah, Host Plus, they were all targeted in what looked like a series of coordinated cyber attacks.
And these funds manage huge amounts of money, right?
Huge. Over a $4.2 trillion collectively. So the potential fallout from successful attacks is just immense.
Did we hear about the actual impact? Were accounts compromised? Money lost?
We did get some specific figures. Australian Super said up to 600 accounts were compromised. And really tragically, four members actually lost money, totaling $500,000. Yeah. And Rest Super found unauthorized access to about 20,000 accounts. They had to shut down their member portal for a while as a precaution.
20,000 accounts access. That's massive.
It is. RT and Insignia Financial also reported unusual login activity, but luckily, no financial losses there, apparently.
That must have sent, well, shockwaves through the whole Australian retirement savings industry. What was the official response?
The National Cybersecurity Coordinator, Michelle McGuinness, she's leading a pretty comprehensive response involving government agencies, financial regulators, the industry itself.
Mm.
Prime Minister Albanese even commented on just how frequent these attacks are in Australia, said they happen about every 6 minutes.
Every 6 minutes?
Yeah. It just highlights how persistent and, well, pervasive this threat landscape really is.
Oh, that's sobering. Constant barrage. Okay, on a slightly more positive note, it seems there are efforts underway, international efforts, to tackle cybercrime, specifically targeting offshore operations.
That's correct. Operation Firestorm. It's a collaboration between the Australian Federal Police, the AFP, and law enforcement over in the Philippines.
Okay.
And the aim is to dismantle these boiler room scam centers that operate outside Australia's direct reach.
And what kind of scams are these boiler rooms running?
They often use really sophisticated social engineering, romance scams, investment fraud. Those are particularly common. And the financial damage is just enormous. Australians alone lost over $2 billion in the past year.
$2 billion.
Yeah. And investment scams were nearly half of that total.
So what's the AFP actually doing in this operation? Are they making arrests in the Philippines?
They're actively involved in providing training and support to the Philippine authorities, like the Presidential Anti-Organized Crime Commission and their Cyber Crime Division.
Ah, okay. Capacity building.
Exactly. Sharing expertise to help the local authorities identify, raid, and ultimately shut down these offshore hubs. And apparently it's already getting results. Hundreds of arrests made, crucial digital evidence seized.
That's good to hear.
Yeah, this kind of international cooperation is just vital, isn't it? Because cybercrime doesn't respect borders. You need that coordinated global response.
Absolutely. Okay, now let's shift focus to some regulatory actions and investigations happening around the world. Starting in the UK, a pretty big fine for a law firm.
Yeah, the UK's Information Commissioner's Office, the ICO, fined a Merseyside law firm called DPP Law LTD £60,000. This was after a major data breach back in June 2022. And this case is just a stark reminder of how critical even basic cybersecurity hygiene is.
What went wrong? What were the specific security failures there?
Well, attackers managed to exploit an admin account that wasn't used very often. And crucially, it didn't have multi-factor authentication, MFA, enabled.
No MFA on an admin account.
Exactly. That lack of a really basic control let them get into the firm's old case management system and just pull out a massive amount of sensitive client data. Over 32 gigabytes, including legally privileged stuff.
Wow. And how did the firm even find out they'd been breached?
Alarmingly, DPP Law only found out when the National Crime Agency told them their client data had turned up on the dark web.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. And to make matters worse, they then delayed reporting it to the ICO by 43 days. Way over the 72-hour limit required by GDPR.
That delay probably didn't help their case with the ICO. What did the investigation conclude?
Well, the ICO investigation clearly pointed to DPP Law's failure to put appropriate security measures in place. Most obviously, the lack of MFA on that admin account, but also failing to patch their systems in a timely way.
Mm-hmm.
It just underscores that legal obligation organizations have. You've got to proactively protect personal data, and you've got to report breaches quickly to minimize harm. It's a costly reminder, you know. Even seemingly small security oversights can have really big consequences.
It certainly sounds like an expensive lesson in cybersecurity 101.
Yeah.
Okay, moving across to Ireland now. The social media platform X, formerly Twitter, is also facing some regulatory heat.
Yes. Ireland's Data Protection Commission, the DPC, has launched a formal investigation into X for a potential breach of the EU's GDPR.
Okay, what's the issue there?
It centers on the alleged use of publicly accessible posts from European users to train their AI chatbot, Grok.
Ah, using user data for AI training.
Exactly, but without getting explicit consent first. That's the core of the issue, the legal requirements around processing personal data for AI training.
Right. Consent seems to be the sticking point here.
Precisely. Back in May 2024, X apparently implemented a default setting that allowed user data to be used for AI training, and users had to actively opt out if they didn't want their data used that way.
And that opt-out approach is the problem under GDPR.
Well, that's what's raised concerns, yeah. GDPR generally requires affirmative, explicit consent and opt-in for processing personal data like this, not just assuming it's okay unless someone objects.
So what's X done in response?
Well, X did agree to temporarily stop this data processing after some legal challenges were mounted, but the DPC's investigation is still ongoing.
And the potential penalties could be significant.
Potentially huge.
Rough.
Fines could reach up to 4% of their global annual revenue if they're found to have violated GDPR. This case really emphasizes that growing regulatory focus on how AI models are built and trained, doesn't it? And the absolute importance of transparent, legally sound ways to get user consent.
Yeah, AI and data privacy are definitely areas getting a lot more regulatory attention everywhere. And we're seeing action in South Korea, too, involving an AI chatbot and data transfers.
That's right. South Korea's Personal Information Protection Commission, or PIPC, found that DeepSeek, which is a Chinese AI chatbot, had been transferring personal data of over a million South Korean users.
Transferring it where?
To servers in both China and the United States. And crucially, without getting the necessary legal consent under South Korean law, this raises some big questions about cross-border data flows and how national privacy laws apply.
What kind of data was being transferred? Was it sensitive?
It sounds like it. The data included things like users' chat histories, unique device identifiers, and patterns of user behavior. Understandably, that triggered pretty significant privacy concerns for the PIPC.
And what happened to DeepSeek as a result?
Well, in response, the PIPC took action to suspend any new downloads of the DeepSeek app within South Korea, at least until the company fixes things and complies with their data protection laws.
Okay.
DeepSeek has publicly acknowledged they fell short here, and they've appointed local lawyers to work on addressing the PIPC's concerns. It just highlights the complexities AI developers face, doesn't it? Operating across different countries with all these varying data protection rules.
It certainly seems like data protection authorities worldwide are getting much more proactive.
Mm-hmm.
Enforcing privacy rules in this digital age. Now, let's turn our attention closer to home. Well, across the Pacific, anyway, the U.S. The sheer scale of cybercrime losses there, the figures are just staggering.
They really are. According to the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center, the IC3 report for 2024, Americans reported a record-breaking $16.6 billion in financial losses due to cybercrime.
$16.6 billion.
Billion, yeah. That's a massive 33% increase compared to the losses reported the year before. It really suggests a significant escalation in the financial impact of these attacks.
That's just an eye-watering amount of money. Did the number of reported crimes go up by that much, too?
Interestingly, no. While the financial losses soared, the actual number of complaints lodged went down slightly to about 859,532.
Huh. Fewer crimes, but much bigger losses.
Exactly. Which suggests a pretty concerning trend, doesn't it? Maybe fewer incidents overall, but the ones that are successful are becoming more sophisticated, causing far greater financial damage. It's like a shift in the nature of cybercrime.
So what were the most common types of cybercrimes driving these losses?
Well, phishing, extortion, and personal data breaches were the most frequently reported types. But investment fraud, especially scams involving cryptocurrencies that accounted for the biggest slice of the financial pie, over $6.5 billion lost just to that.
$6.5 billion to investment fraud alone. Wow.
Yeah, it really points to a significant shift towards financially motivated attacks that are leveraging these newer technologies.
And were any particular groups hit harder than others?
Sadly, yes. Individuals aged 60 and older were disproportionately affected. They filed a huge number of complaints, 147,127, and their losses totaled nearly $5 billion.
$5 billion lost by older adults.
Yeah. It really highlights how vulnerable older adults can be to certain types of scams and just underscores that critical need for targeted education and support to help protect them online.
These U.S. figures really paint a stark picture, don't they? The massive economic impact of cybercrime on a national scale. Okay, finally, let's dig into some important updates from NIST. That's the National Institute of Standards and Technology, right?
Mm.
Regarding cybersecurity incident response.
That's right. NIST recently released a really significant update to its main incident response guidance. It's called SP 800-61 Revision 3, released in April 2025. This is a major overhaul from Revision 2, which dated all the way back to 2012.
Wow, 2012. A lot's changed since then.
Exactly. This evolution in guidance really reflects the changing nature of cyber threats and all the lessons learned over the past decade plus.
So what makes this particular update so significant for organizations, you know, day to day?
Well, this revision represents a real strategic shift in how organizations should think about and approach incident response. It moves away from just being reactive, you know, cleaning up after something happens,
right,
towards a much more integrated and proactive approach. And it's closely aligned now with a main NIST cybersecurity framework, the CSF 2.0.
Okay, and the CSF covers things like govern, identify, protect.
Exactly. Govern, identify, protect, detect, respond, and recover. This alignment basically recognizes that incident response isn't some standalone activity off to the side. It's an integral part of your whole risk management strategy, especially with threats getting more sophisticated and persistent.
So why should organizations here in New Zealand really pay attention to these NIST updates? I mean, it's a U.S. standard.
That's a fair question. But as the bulletin highlights, New Zealand has certainly had its share of major cyber incidents recently, and they often revealed weaknesses in how prepared organizations were to respond effectively. What we've generally seen is that organizations with well-established incident response plans, you know, clear playbooks, buy-in from the top, pre-agreed coordination with legal comms teams, they've generally been much better placed to minimize the damage.
Makes sense.
And while all sectors face risks, there's maybe an indication that professional services firms in particular might be lagging a bit in their cyber incident readiness. So adopting these structured, up-to-date practices like the ones in SP 800-61-R3, it's really essential for strengthening our overall national cyber resilience here too.
Okay. So what are some of the key changes or enhancements in this new Revision 3?
There are several important updates. Firstly, that strong alignment with CSF 2.0 is key. It puts incident response squarely within the bigger picture of cybersecurity posture, from governance all the way through to recovery.
Right.
Secondly, there's a really significant emphasis now on continuous improvement, the idea that you should learn from every incident, big or small, and use those lessons to make your plans, your training, your security controls better.
Learn from mistakes, essentially.
Pretty much. Thirdly, the guidance now stresses involving a much wider range of stakeholders in incident response, not just the IT folks, but executive leadership, legal, HR, even external partners.
It gets everyone on the same page.
Hopefully. And finally, SP 800-61-R3 now points organizations towards dynamic, frequently updated online resources like NIST's Cybersecurity and Privacy Reference Tool, the CPRT, for the latest guidance and tools, rather than just relying on a static document.
The bulletin also laid out three essential steps for organizations wanting to get aligned with this new guidance. What are those?
Yeah, three key things. First, you need to thoroughly benchmark where you are right now. Assess your current incident response capabilities against a recognized framework like that NIST CSF 2.0.
And that's not just tech stuff.
No, not at all. It includes looking at your governance structures, who's responsible for what, your escalation paths, how decisions get made during a crisis, and importantly, understanding your reliance on third-party vendors and your supply chain.
Okay, benchmark first. What's step two?
Step two is simulation and training. Conducting regular, realistic exercises. Tabletop exercises involving that broad range of stakeholders, execs, ops teams, legal, comms, key third parties.
Practicing for the real thing.
Exactly. Using scenarios relevant to your risks, maybe ransomware, a major data breach, a cloud compromise. Testing both the technical response and the business continuity side. And crucially, doing proper after-action reports afterwards to see what worked and what didn't.
Right. Learn from the practice, too. And the final step.
The final essential step is to really institutionalize that post-incident learning. After every actual incident, no matter how small it seems, have a structured process to review what happened. Look at the technical findings, the timelines, how well coordination worked, key decisions made.
Involve everyone again.
Yep. Involve all the relevant stakeholders. And then actively use those lessons learned to update your playbooks, your training, your system configurations, even your business continuity plans. It's that feedback loop that drives continuous improvement and builds real long-term cyber resilience.
This updated NIST guidance, it really sounds like a very comprehensive forward-thinking framework, helping organizations properly mature their incident response and take a much more strategic view of managing these constantly evolving cyber risks.
Precisely. It's really about moving beyond just reacting when bad things happen. It's about building a robust, adaptable system that minimizes disruption and ensures you can respond effectively and coordinate well in what's just an increasingly complex and, frankly, challenging threat environment.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into the latest in cybersecurity, it's just so clear, isn't it? The digital world offers huge benefits, but it definitely presents this constantly shifting landscape of risks. That very interconnectedness that makes it so powerful also means threats popping up in one place can spread incredibly fast and have really far-reaching consequences.
Exactly. And as we've sort of explored today, from those new banking protections here in NZ to the global fight against scammers and these updated best practices from NIST, there's this continuous cycle, isn't there? Adapting, innovating, trying to understand and manage these risks better.
And for you, our listener, we really hope this deep dive has given you those essential insights without, you know, completely overwhelming you with detail. Hopefully a clearer picture of the current cybersecurity landscape and some key things to think about.
Which I guess raises a fundamental question for all of us, really. Given these global trends, given how sophisticated cyber threats are becoming, how truly prepared are you, or maybe your organization? How prepared are you to effectively navigate this ever-changing digital world? It's definitely a question worth mulling over, I think, as we all keep trying to manage the complexities of our connected lives and, well, whatever technology throws at us next.